First, let me thank you for your patience and courtesy in helping us get things switched around to accommodate a lawyer who needed to attend a funeral. And we're happy to have you. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Our panel is today Justice Sue Walker, Justice Bob McCoy, and myself, Justice Ann Gardner. And we'll go ahead and get started if it's okay with you. We have a busy afternoon with three oral arguments scheduled. And I'll ask Bonnie to call the first case. Thank you, Bonnie. Mr. Jones, are you ready to begin?
I'm ready, Your Honor.
Okay, proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, my name is John Jones, and I represent Liberty Bank, the appellant in this case. And my argument will cover why the trial court erred in granting the appellee's motion for summary judgment and denying enforcement of Liberty Bank's Iowa judgment and finding it void. The trial court erred because and this court has a long history in uniform enforcement of Foreign Justice Judgment Act cases, but the appellee's summary judgment proof was insufficient. It did not overcome the presumption of validity needed to overcome the judgment. In Texas, we have the statutory scheme at Chapter 35 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and as this court pointed out in both the Minute Maid Press International case and the Cinemacar lease case, there are two grounds to challenge the jurisdiction of a sister state to render a foreign judgment. And those two grounds are simply the defendant may try to demonstrate that service of process was inadequate under the rules of the sister state, or the exercise of jurisdiction doesn't meet the requirement of that state's long-arm statute and due process of law. The Minuteman case goes into great detail, both on the federal side and the state side, on the full faith and credit clause under Article 4, Section 1, the federal statute, and the other, and the state statute that follows after that. The one of the problems on insufficient proof is once the authenticated judgment has been filed under the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgment Act, Chapter 35, it becomes prima facie proof and is entitled to full faith and credit. The burden then is on the defendant to show why it shouldn't be enforced, and then they have to show why the service of the process was inadequate under the sister state's law, or the exercise of jurisdiction was inadequate or didn't comply under the sister state's law. In this case, the motion for summary judgment which is at pages 544 and 546 of the reference, is the actual motion. Mr. Etter's affidavit is at page 547 and 549 of the record, and then the exhibits are at 550 to 563. Doesn't give any description of what Iowa law is and why, under Iowa law, the judgment shouldn't be given full faith and credit. There's actually no mention of it in the motion for summary judgment. There's no reference to Iowa law or why under Iowa law. There's no evidence of that at all in the affidavit to show why under Iowa law the judgment shouldn't be entitled to full faith and credit. And I don't believe there's been any allegations, and none that I'm aware of in the record, showing that service of process was inadequate. Mr. Etter did appear, albeit while a special appearance, and an answer subject to the special appearance, and some other, a telephonic hearing, and some other things in Iowa. But I don't believe there's been any issue raised concerning service of process. But there is no discussion or even reference in the record of the Iowa court's long-arm statute, or, as in this case, the trial court below, County Court 3, held that there was no subject matter jurisdiction. Iowa district courts are courts of general jurisdiction, and the site for that would be Shire versus State, 573 Northwest 2nd, 242.
But counsel, the real issue is the impact of the judgment from the 270th District Court, and you haven't really addressed that. We have that judgment saying that the contracts are basically subject to scrutiny.
Your Honor, the factual, and I was going to get to that, but I'll jump to that ahead. The judgment, the default judgment taken by the 270 District Court, did not, and we've attached in the record the service sheets from the Harris County District Court, which is at page appendix 2 to the my affidavit, so it's around 582 to 584. Liberty Bank was never served in that case, and what they're asking the court to do, what the default judgment attempts to do, is to find that something that's not before the court, which is the equipment rental agreement. The equipment rental agreement had been assigned by Norvergence and fully funded and paid for by Liberty Bank in May of 2004. In July, end of June, 1st of July of 2004, Norvergence filed for bankruptcy. It was a Chapter 7, and a number of creditors forced them into bankruptcy. The whatever consisted of the equipment rental agreement had already been assigned. It was not property of the estate, and I've cited the two cases by the Fifth Circuit, one involving a spousal agreement which had been divided and ruled on before the bankruptcy, to show that even though the bankruptcy definition of what's part of the estate, what would belong to Norvergence, be subject to claims under the either an adversarial proceeding or other thing, had already been gone out and given to the spouse, and therefore it's not property of the state and not before the court. That's also the same thing that Judge Edelman in the First District Court of Appeals in Houston came up with in the Studebaker-Worthing versus Texas Shutters case, because the issue was raised whether or not the bankruptcy affected that ERA, which was also a Norvergence ERA.
But okay, we're really not talking about the bankruptcy. We're talking about the 270th court's judgment.
If the judgment of the 270th court was rendered during the bankruptcy or while Norvergence still owned the agreement, then I guess it would have been void unless there had been a lift of the stay. But if it was already transferred, how does that impact Liberty Bank?
Well, that is the key thing, and Liberty Bank, in both at the trial court and now, acknowledges that had the equipment rental agreement been still with Norvergence, had not been assigned prior to the bankruptcy, and before the Attorney General had filed suit, had it still been part of Norvergence estate, the judgment of the 270th court would have been effective as to the equipment rental agreement. Fortunately for Liberty Bank, the agreement had been assigned to Liberty Bank in May of 2004 prior to the bankruptcy, so it was not property of the estate, and therefore when the AG sued Norvergence in end of November 2004, it wasn't before the court. The property of which you're trying to get an interim judgment on was not before the court, not part of the estate of Norvergence, and therefore the ruling of the 270th District Court would have no effect on it because it wasn't part of Norvergence. They didn't own it, had no entrance to it. The entire equipment rental agreement had been assigned and fully funded by Liberty Bank. So it wasn't before the court in Houston, and that's a key point.
But I thought that the Houston litigation was under the DTPA. I don't see how the property really has anything to do with the DTPA claim.
Well, first of all, Norvergence did not appear at the default judgment hearing, didn't file any answer, and it does make a difference under the DTPA. The history of which I guess this court could take judicial notice, the first lawsuit involving Norvergence, and I believe the Texas one was the second one, was a case by the state of Florida versus Popular Leasing et al., in which the because there's a national committee of attorney generals, of which the Texas AG was one of them. When they filed that initial lawsuit in Florida and brought in the leasing companies under the Florida Deceptive Trade Practices Act, the leasing companies who were then served and did appear with counsel won that case, and the AG's complaint was dismissed. From then on, none of the leasing companies were ever sued again, and so the default judgment was taken without any notice of the lawsuit being filed. In fact, the only knowledge of the case that I gained was after coming out of a meeting with the Attorney General and finding out that they had taken a default judgment against Norvergence. I never was aware of anything prior to that. And so then that was the date of the default judgment. But it is important that whether it's a DTPA or not, the fact that the property had been assigned and had been paid for under normal contract law by Liberty Bank, the fact that it wasn't in Norvergence estate makes a huge difference. Because
it might make a difference as to who your remedy's against, but I'm not seeing as it makes a difference to the judgment rendered by the 270th District Court.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that, because under that argument, then the AG could go down and file a claim under against any contract under arguably under the DTPA or under any other law and void contracts that are in commerce and affect other notes or whatever without the other parties ever having a right to defend their property rights, because the assigned contract is a property right of Liberty Bank, and they should have been if the intent was for their equipment rental agreements that had been assigned to them and fully paid for prior to the bankruptcy were to be before the court, then the Attorney General should have brought them in. One of the matters cited by Mr. Etter in his brief is the IFC case. If the argument is true that the default judgment did it, there would have been no need for the Attorney General to sue IFC under the very same theory. You could have just gone to the 270th District Court and said they're violating this so-called injunction and filed a motion for contempt and stopped them from doing what they're doing, and that's not what they did. The point is, in the whole record, the only leasing company that the Attorney General sought to even serve or have any kind of affidavit evidence of in the Norvergence case was Preferred Capital, and they had no evidence from any other leasing companies, and they didn't have any from Liberty Bank.
Is there evidence in the summary judgment record that Liberty Bank had actual notice?
No.
I thought the Attorney General sent...
Well, he sent a notice. The Attorney General sent us I forget what it's called. It's a CID. It's a request for documents to all the leasing companies, 41 of us in the country, just to ask us to produce documents. And we all did produce documents under, it's like a subpoena, a civil investigative demand. And so we did produce it, but they didn't interfere. And I was truthfully involved in 114 of these cases. They didn't interfere in any of the other cases. And the default judgment actually always came up. And so the fact that they made a subpoena request, which is what a civil investigative demand really is, which we complied with, we provided them all the documents, the equipment rental agreements had been signed, we provided all that to them. That doesn't put us on notice, because when the civil investigative demand was made, that was after the assignment. I believe the civil investigative demand would have been in October of 2004, and the assignment of the equipment rental agreement occurred in May of 2004. It's only after Norvergence was in bankruptcy and some issues came up that these civil investigative demands were issued by the Supreme Court. And so it is very important that the ERA was not, the equipment rental agreement was not before the Norvergence court in the 270th District Court. We acknowledge that had it not been assigned, once the lawsuit had been filed and the judgment had taken by the AG, there would have been a problem. The fact that it was assigned prior to it in the first litigation actually was the Liberty Bank litigation in Iowa over a month before the Attorney General initiated their litigation. The first litigation involved Liberty Bank and Mr. Etter in October of 2004. I think it does make a difference, because I don't believe under the cases I've cited dealing with certificate or service of citation, all that you can take away someone's property and not give them notice that you're trying to do that. I think everybody would be surprised.
This might not have been raised in the motion for summary judgment, but our response, I'm just curious to know if it has any effect that the that Liberty Bank was an assignee. Would it not have been in privity with Norvergence?
The answer, Your Honor, is no. Had they would be in privity, the cases that talk about sort of the res judicata effect and all that is if they had been closely connected and their interests would have been represented by Norvergence at the default judgment hearing, that there might have been a different issue. If you look, and I'll have to get you the page number on my rebuttal, but there is a discussion of why the Iowa court didn't enforce the default judgment in Texas, and they go through a detailed analysis of that in the Liberty Bank versus Best Litho case, and I'll get you the page citation for that in the record, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll hear from the appellee, Andrew Bishop Etter.
May it please the court, counsel. For the record, my name is Andrew Bishop Etter II. Andrew Etter is my father, but I am representing the appellee here today. I just want to make that clear for the record. Article 4, Section 1 of the U.S. Constitution, known as the Full Faith and Credit Clause, ensures that states within the United States respect the public acts, records, and judicial proceedings of the other states. Liberty Bank has gone to great lengths in their argument today and their brief submitted to the court to advise the court of the importance of the Full Faith and Credit Clause in the validity of its Iowa judgment here in Texas. Liberty Bank argues that by looking at anything other than their Iowa judgment counts as an impermissible collateral attack on the Iowa judgment and offends the Full Faith and Credit Clause. Liberty Bank would have you believe that Etter is attempting to choose a forum simply because he is dissatisfied with the results in Iowa. Etter, though, did not participate in the merits of Liberty Bank's claims and a default judgment was entered against him in Iowa. Moreover, Etter is a Texas resident and is afforded the protection of Texas laws and policies. This is not simply a case of a valid foreign judgment being recognized in Texas. It is a case where a foreign judgment or foreign state lacked the subject matter jurisdiction to enter a judgment which Liberty Bank now claims is valid and enforceable in Texas.
Well, what's the basis of the lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
I'll get into it more during my argument, okay. But basically they lack subject matter jurisdiction once the 270th held the ERA void. That was entered in April of 2005. A judgment against Etter was entered in Iowa in 2008, over 3 years after the subject matter had been lost. Because when the AG entered, when the 270th held that the ERA was void, Iowa lost the subject matter jurisdiction it had over the ERA and Etter because he, as a Texas consumer.
Okay, so it's not lack of minimum contacts or lack of personal jurisdiction.
No, it's not lack of personal jurisdiction at all, and I think Liberty Bank would, and rightly so, would say that he was served and he was reached according to their long-arm statute. But as Supreme Court law points out, you have to have both personal and subject matter jurisdiction for a judgment to be valid. In April of 2004, Etter was approached by a Norvergence sales representative who advised Etter that Norvergence's Merge Access Transport Intelligent Exchange, otherwise known as the Matrix Box, would drastically cut down his telecommunications bill. Etter entered into an agreement with Norvergence and in doing so signed many documents, one of which is known as the Equipment Rental Agreement, the ERA. The ERA was supposed to cover the Matrix device itself. It was supposed to be a lease. As our brief points out, Norvergence never possessed the technology it claimed to be selling was actually operating an extrinsic Ponzi scheme. The Matrix device was not the patented property of Norvergence. It was just a regular router that did nothing to save clients money. Another part of Norvergence's fraudulent scheme was to assign these ERAs to these leasing companies to get quick cash. That's how they kept the Ponzi scheme going. There were over 20 different banks which were assigned these ERAs. In this case, Liberty Bank was assigned Etter's ERA in May of 2004. A month prior to Etter's lease payment being due, his first one, Norvergence was forced into bankruptcy in New Jersey. The Matrix device that Norvergence installed in Etter's office never worked. It was never hooked up. Liberty Bank, though, still attempted to collect from Etter on the ERA. Etter refused to pay, and Liberty Bank initiated an action against Etter in Iowa. On November 18, 2004, the Attorney General of Texas filed a suit against Noor Virgins under Section 17.41 of Texas's Deceptive Trade Practices Act in the 270th District Court. The AG brought the action on behalf of Texas consumers for the fraudulent actions of Noor Virgins in inducing Texas consumers to sign the ERA. On November 19th of 2004, the Attorney General of Texas sent Liberty Bank a civil investigative demand letter, which advised them of the questionable circumstances surrounding Noor Virgins' procurement of the ERAs with Texas consumers. Moreover, and most importantly, the letter instructed Liberty Bank to cease all collection activities against Texas consumers like Etter until a determination was made as to whether the ERA was enforceable against a Texas consumer.
So did the letter notify them of the lawsuit as well? Was it sent the day after suit was filed?
It did not advise them of the lawsuit, but it did, like I said, it did say cease all efforts to collect until such time as a determination is made as to the enforceability.
Okay.
On April 28, 2005, a default judgment was entered against Noor Virgins in the 270th District Court case. Paragraph 11 of the default judgment reads, all ERAs or other contracts procured between Noor Virgins and Texas consumers or between finance companies and Texas consumers as a result of Noor Virgins solicitation directed to any Texas consumer are the results of deceptive and unfair practices and fraud on part of Noor Virgins and therefore are declared void, ab initio, and unenforceable. Once the AG held the ERA to be void under Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act, Liberty Bank lost all its power to enforce the ERA against the Texas consumer. The AG used the word ab initio to exemplify that the ERAs are non-enforceable in Texas. It's as if they never existed. The Texas Court of Appeals in Houston held in Seafarers Welfare Plan v. George E. Lightboat Storage Incorporated that a contract is not, if it's held void, a contract is not a contract at all, it binds no one, and is a nullity. Liberty Bank argues that the judgment of the 270th does not affect them since they were not named a party and they were not served with process. Etter does not claim that the 270th held personal jurisdiction, but does argue that Iowa lost subject matter jurisdiction when the 270th of Harris County held the ERA void against Texas consumers. As held in the United States Supreme Court case of Baker v. General Motors, a judgment of a sister state is afforded full faith and credit only if rendered by a court with jurisdiction over the parties and the subject matter. Moreover, as held in Texas Court of Appeals Waco case, Allied Van Lines Incorporated v. Central Forwarding Incorporated, when matters of public interest are adjudicated, the effect of the judgment is binding on all parties who have an interest in the subject matter of the suit, whether they are parties to the former suit or not. And again, Iowa lost subject matter jurisdiction on April 29th of 2005 when the 270th held all the ERAs were void. Iowa entered a judgment against Etter in July of 2008, over 3 years after the holding of the 270th. Thus, Liberty Bank's reliance on the full faith and credit clause is inapplicable here. To prove the Attorney General of Texas meant its judgment to apply to leasing companies like Liberty Bank, the Attorney General brought an action against a similar leasing company in the state of Texas versus IFC Credit Corp. IFC was a similar assignee of contracts. IFC happened to have millions and millions of dollars invested in this, though, and they were going after Texas consumers directly in Harris County, unlike Liberty Bank, who went after Texas consumers in Iowa. The AG alleged that IFC was attempting to collect on the ERAs in Texas, which were previously held void by the 270th decision. Although this case was not settled and therefore has no binding effect on this court, it is the clearest example that the AG believed his actions were sufficient to void the obligations of Texas consumers under the ERA, even in regards to the leasing companies who had been assigned to the ERA. The AG most likely did not name Liberty Bank as a defendant in the 270th action because the AG knew of the problems of bringing in 20-plus out-of-state defendants who then, at that time, held these ERAs. And as I'm sure you're going to guess, my next point will be that the AG knew these were out-of-state companies, and had the AG brought them in, they would have filed special appearances and said, there's no jurisdiction over me. I've done nothing in your state yet. And in fact, in the trial court, Liberty Bank made that argument several times. Liberty Bank could have intervened in the 270th to protect its interest. They stated in the trial court that they were aware of the action, and as previously mentioned, the Attorney General of Texas sent Liberty Bank a civil investigative demand letter in November of 2004. Despite all of this, though, Liberty Bank chose to ignore the AG of Texas's letter, ignore the 270th District Court's holding, continue its action against Etter in Iowa, obtain an Iowa judgment against Etter, and then file for enforcement action in Texas under the guise of the full faith and credit clause.
But does the record reflect in the summary judgment proceedings when Liberty Bank acquired knowledge of the 270th lawsuit?
Your Justice, I do believe it does, but I don't have the exact site now, but I will be able to get that to you.
That's okay. We'll find it.
At some time. I know the editor filed an affidavit which Liberty Bank did not object to, claiming that they knew about it. But if I need to get a site for you, I certainly will. Aside from the full faith and credit issue, Liberty Bank argues that the trial court did not possess the plenary power to grant Etter's motion for summary judgment. Etter filed a request for injunctive relief and declaratory judgment citing the subject matter argument in Tarrant County Court at Law No. 3, the trial court below. Liberty Bank was instructed by the trial court on July 24, 2008, that Liberty Bank was not allowed to enforce their Iowa judgment until the trial court decided on Liberty Bank's declaratory judgment action against Liberty Bank. Knowing of the ongoing battle in the trial court, Liberty Bank ignored the trial court's instruction, ignored the compulsory counterclaim rule found in Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 97A, and filed a separate cause for enforcement of its Iowa judgment. It was assigned a cause in Tarrant County Court at Law No. 1. In response to Liberty Bank's enforcement filing, Etter filed a motion to vacate in the Tarrant County Court at Law No. 1 and a motion to consolidate in the Tarrant County Court at Law No. 3.
Dominant jurisdiction?
Yes. Liberty Bank claims, since Etter never obtained a hearing date on his motion to vacate in the Tarrant County Court at Law No. 1 case, their action, Liberty Bank's Iowa judgment became valid in Texas by operation of law under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 329B. However, a void contract possesses no legal effect, and its invalidity can be asserted by any person whose rights are affected and at any time, in any place, directly or collaterally, as held in Texas Court of Appeals of Eastland, Reynolds v. Volunteer. Liberty Bank's argument that full faith and credit clause prevents a Texas court from doing anything else than enforcing an Iowa judgment ignores the fact that the 270th held the ERA void and that it can be attacked at any time and any place. In conclusion, the trial court was correct in granting Etter's motion for summary judgment. Because the actions of the AG were within his constitutional authority under the DTPA, and as such, the ERA is void against Texas consumers. Iowa lost subject matter jurisdiction when the ERA was held void. When a sister state lacks subject matter jurisdiction, then the judgment is not afforded full faith and credit in another state. By holding otherwise, this court would empower creditors to assign their fraudulent contracts to third parties who would then obtain out-of-state judgments and file for enforcement in Texas under the full faith and credit clause. The full faith and credit clause certainly is not intended to promote the laundering of fraudulent contracts. Etter urges the court to uphold the trial court's decision. Thank you. I yield my remainder time to any questions you might have.
Question? No.
Thank you, okay, Justice.
Thank you very much. And now we'll hear rebuttal if you have an additional 5 minutes.
Your Honor, the site in the record to the Liberty Bank Best Litho case is at page 293, is where that case starts. And just to make some points of clarification, the Iowa court did not issue a default judgment. They issued a summary judgment, which had been served upon Mr. Etter, and it was a summary judgment that the court ruled upon in granting the judgment. So it was not a default judgment. In addition, I would point out in the record, Appendix 1 to my affidavit, which starts at page 582. When we filed this Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, instead of just filing the single judgment, we filed almost all the pleadings, the summary judgment, the responses, and everything, certified copies in the County Court at Law Number 1. It was filed in County Court Law Number 1 simply because that's the court that was assigned. We don't get to pick. It's when you file under Chapter 35 of the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, you file an application, and the clerk gets to assign it under the wheel to the appropriate court, and that's what happened. I would say that when the foreign judgment was filed, the motion to vacate filed by Mr. Etter was timely, but they did not seek a hearing on the motion to vacate or stay the foreign judgment that had been filed, and after 75 days, it had been overruled by operation of law. Your Honor, unless y'all have any additional questions, I think that's all the cleanup I have, and I thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your arguments, both of you, and your appearance here today, and your briefs. This is a very difficult case, and it is submitted, and we will take it under advisement, and you're excused. Thank you very much. Thank you.